Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Back in October, hardly anyone had even heard of the online word-guessing game Wordle. It was on a really basic, simple, ad-free website. The New York Times says by November, the game had 90 users. Fast forward to about 2.5 weeks ago, 300,000. Today, millions. It's no wonder the Times bought it this week, reportedly for a price in the low seven figures. If you're not familiar, the point is to come up with the correct five-letter word. Start with any word. It lets you know which letter's in the right place, which are in the wrong place, which ones don't belong at all. You get six chances to figure it out. Then you can brag to everyone on social media that you solved it, as many have done. That got us thinking, maybe there is a talk show segment here, not just about Wordle itself, but other brain teasers. After all, public radio listeners like words and numbers and puzzles and games, right? So here's your chance to tell us what you like to play. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite word game or puzzle? What is your favorite and why? Is it Wordle? Are you pretty good at it? Or do you have to go on Google and cheat? Maybe you play Words with Friends or Scrabble, Crosswords, Word Finds. We'll throw Wheel of Fortune out there too. Maybe Sudoku if you're more into numbers. What is your go-to word game or puzzle? If you got any tips on how to win at them, you can share those as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. No guest for this one. You are our guest, counting on you to help carry things along. We pose these questions to our WPR and PBS Wisconsin colleagues. Here's what Willa Schlecht in WPR's administration and finance office had to say about her favorite game.
I play the New York Times Spelling Bee, and I've been doing it for about 6 months. It's an anagram of seven letters where you have to figure out all the words in a list. And what I found out after I got addicted is that if you get all the words in the list, a little bee will buzz all over your screen. But I have never gotten all of the words. 3 a.m. every night, Central Standard Time, they drop the prior day's list of words. And this morning, I was just one word off from getting the buzzing bee. I've never been competitive, but I am with this game. And the word I missed was hotly, and I'm hotly disappointed that I missed it. They allow you to scramble the letters in the game. And so you just keep scrambling letters and trying to come up with combinations of four or more letters. And there's always extra bonus points for a pantogram, which uses all of the letters. And it's a wonderful addiction.
Do you have a wonderful addiction to a puzzle or word game online in a paper, in a magazine? Call 800-642-1234 to share yours. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Portage. Mike, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your game, Mike?
I do Wordle. I also do Sudoku. Did you know that Wordle is actually the same exact game as an old game show that used to be hosted by Chuck Woolery called Lingo?
I remember Lingo. I watched it on the game show channel, and I'd forgotten it until you just said the word just now.
I loved that game. It was my favorite game. So seeing Wordle is really nice for me.
Cool. And, you know, I think of the old Mastermind game where it was colors and you had to say how many you had right, how many in the right place and so on. Did you ever play that back in the day, Mike?
I did not, no.
Okay. So if you like Wordle, I don't know, you might like Mastermind. So you said Sudoku. Have you been into Sudoku for years and years?
I have. I played it. I used to play it in books, but now it's on an app on my phone. But Sudoku, I can't remember. There's another one and I can't remember the name of it, but it's another one that's similar to Sudoku, using numbers to fill out puzzles in the same way.
I'm good at Sudoku when it's like the one star, the easy versions. I have to give up halfway through on the tough ones. Can you get those like really challenging ones?
I sometimes can. It's really difficult.
We've scrambled not just the words, but your call there, Mike. But thank you so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234. With the rise of Wordle, we're asking for your favorite word games, puzzle games, whether you do them online, in person, or maybe you play Scrabble or other Boggle, maybe, with friends or family. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us if there's a daily habit of yours when it comes to puzzles or word games. Morning show producer Mackenzie Crummy, by the way, we just heard about Sudoku. Mackenzie says, I play Sudoku most days can rarely solve a six-star puzzle from the Saturday edition of the Wisconsin State Journal. If anyone has tips on how to make it past the initial techniques of scanning and naked pairs, I'd love to hear them. I think I know what those are. I don't really know the strategy phrases. Do you Sudoku? 800-642-1234 is the number to call in with your word game. We heard from Ezra Wall, manager of WPR's lacrosse region, with a favorite word game memory.
My former colleague Karen was the classical music announcer at the radio station we both used to work at, and she started a thing where randomly we would leave cryptograms on each other's desks. And instead of being a quip or a common quote, it would usually be some kind of inspirational quote from a thought leader like Thich Nhat Hanh or Desmond Tutu or something like that. And in addition to being fun and challenging, it always made us feel better about the day. I miss those days.
Thanks, Ezra. An inspirational puzzle. I like that. Now, this is bringing back memories. When I was a kid, well, I was a nerd, no surprise there. I used to get Games Magazine, which they had reviews of board games, which I liked. And then it was packed full of puzzles, including cryptograms, like Ezra was talking about there. Cryptic crosswords, which I'm still hooked on when I can find them to this day. Can't always finish those either. What's yours? 800-642-1234 is the number to call with your puzzles and word games. Let's go back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Oh, dear, dear, I'm so happy to be in touch with you because I have an absolute passion for cryptograms. And I do believe it's so mentally challenging, but so much fun. And I want to make you aware, Rob, that there is a magazine called Cryptogram Special. Ooh. I will send you a copy of where you can get this delivered to your house. There are 350 cryptograms each and every month.
It's
wow. So wonderful.
That's a great
spot. And you don't get a clue as you do in the daily newspaper.
Ooh.
They don't give you a clue. And that's, I just love these. I've been a crossword addict my whole life, but cryptograms even beat crossword puzzles.
Now, Nancy, for someone who's never done a cryptogram, can you explain what they are? It's been a while since I've done one, I'll be honest.
Well, you're decoding something that somebody has encoded. Substituting one letter for another. And you soon begin to know how to do this fairly rapidly because you can see the repetitiveness of the letter E, for instance, and you can see the repetitiveness of the starting of the words with TH. But after I'd started doing them, I realized I could tell that something had actually changed in my brain. I felt a different rewiring in my brain.
Wow.
And but don't give me anything to do with numbers. I would never do a Sudoku or whatever it is. Never. Words, beautiful English words. That's my passion.
I love it. Nancy, thank you so much. I know what you mean about the brain. Sometimes when I'm doing a cryptic crossword and I crack one that had been stumping me for a while, I feel like a little whoosh of happy brain activity. So I'm right there with you. Mark joins us next in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hey, it's not exactly the same as what you're talking about, but my coworkers and I are hospice workers, and every year we probably over 100 people help them pass on. And throughout the year, we just try and remember the names of all the people we cared for. We'll just send a name in a text message or in an email, just reminding us of the names and the stories of who we've cared for. Keep your mind strong and keeping the energy going for those families.
Mark, and it's a tribute to the people you've cared for, too, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Mark, thank you so much for sharing that with us. That's a great story. We are talking about our favorite word and number games and brain teasers and puzzles. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to game or puzzle? Have you been swept up in the Wordle craze? Are you tired of people posting their Wordle patterns on your social media? Is there a brain teaser, a puzzle you do every single day? Why do you play? What do you get out of it? Is there something you recommend that people try out? Tell us about your strategies, your favorites right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about games, puzzles, and brain teasers. It's a fun topic with all the buzz surrounding the online word guessing game Wordle. According to the New York Times, it had 90 users back in November. Today, millions play it daily. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us if and why you play this new Wordle or other games you enjoy as well in the word and puzzle categories. Jumbles, crosswords, word finds, words with friends, Sudoku, you name it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Amy is with us in Madison. Amy, hi.
Hello.
What's your game, Amy?
I was invited back as a returning second place champion to the Mount Horeb Scandahoovian Fest Adult Spelling Bee.
Ooh. Were you always good at spelling, Amy? Were you good at spelling bees as a kid?
No, I got pretty far, and then I'd screw up on some brain fart or another. But I always thought of myself as being very good with spelling. I find copy errors all the time when I'm reading. I convinced a good friend of mine to join me one year, and then so she and I placed first and second that year. And this after like getting out the first year, I attempted on a very embarrassing word. I think it was amnesia. And then the following year, she flunked out on another embarrassingly easy word. Of course, you remember all those words that you screw up. But it was most exciting, and there were some really bizarre words in their word list. And it's a hoot because the people who hold it are, they're up for some crazy fun. So it's kind of fun.
Amy, thank you so much for sharing that. That sounds great. At 800-642-1234, that's 800-642-1234. Ask you for your favorite word games or puzzles or number puzzles like Sudokus. 800-642-1234. Yeah, I remember one elementary school spelling bee. My dad worked in the city of Taylor, Michigan, T-A-Y-L-O-R. And I got the word Taylor, T-A-I-L-O-R, in the spelling bee. I got it wrong. I spelled the city, and I was out. We asked around WPR for word game stories. You could join in with yours at 800-642-1234. Here's Kathy Miner, a volunteer in the WPR Simply Folk Music Library.
I am a total public radio nerd and a word nerd besides. I've been playing the NPR Sunday puzzle since, as Will Short says, the postcard days. I make sure I'm awake by 7:45 every Sunday morning, and I have a little notebook and pen at my bedside. I play along with the randomly selected on-air contestant, sometimes, I'll admit it, shouting at the radio when the answer is unbearably obvious, other times being amazed at how quickly they get the solutions while I'm still fumbling.
I'm going to give you some categories in two words. You name something in each category, starting with each initial in the category. Any answer that works is fine. For example, if I said zoo animals, you might say zebra, aardvark.
Okay.
Okay. Number one is Greek letters.
Gamma, lambda.
That is correct. Number two is roulette.
Then when Will announces the next week's challenge, I jot down cryptic instructions. And when I go downstairs, I post the challenge in a special spot on the side of the refrigerator, the better to refer to it over the next few days. If the puzzle involves any anagramming, I get out my trusty Scrabble tiles. Saves a lot of erasing and frustration. I don't solve the puzzle every week, far from it. But if I do, I enter the answer online. I'm still waiting for that Thursday phone call inviting me to play on the air.
Good luck, Kathy. We are asking for your favorite word games and puzzles at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us next in Waukesha. Jeff, hi.
Hi, Rob. I played Mastermind, like you mentioned, and I thought that was an excellent relationship to Wordle. And I wish they had a Wordle that had 6-letter words or 3-letter words, because once a day is not enough for Wordle.
Yeah, I think that's part of the charm for some people, though. They get their one dose of Wordle and that's it. You want more, though, Jeff.
I do, but I appreciate that I can't have it, because that does keep me hooked on it. And I was thinking about getting Classic Battleship out to introduce to my children, so that they could do, I can't see it, but I have to imagine what's on the other side of the wall, a puzzle game.
That sounds great. And make sure they don't stack those ships up like everybody's older sibling did back in the day.
No cheating. Yes.
And Jeff, Wordle is a puzzle. Are there other puzzles you're into?
I can do Sudoku, and I recently got a book where they did a picture for a letter. Nancy, your caller, was talking about cryptograms where it's maybe a letter for letter, and she recognizes the T-H-E combination very easily, but this was like a triangle would be a letter, and a square would be a letter, and it was for the kids to solve a simple phrase.
Interesting. Jeff, thanks a lot for sharing that, and you're passing it on to the next generation. I love it. Well, with the rise of Wordle, we're asking you to share your favorite puzzles and word games and number games, maybe, if you'd like, or number puzzles like Sudoku. Still time for your call, your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kathy joins us next in Appleton. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I love crosswords myself, but my favorite game with my husband is Scrabble. We've been playing Scrabble together every day for the last several years, and it might sound odd, but we often play at dinner time. And I know you're not supposed to do anything when you eat. You're supposed to concentrate on your eating. But it gives us time to just kind of connect with each other and say, how was your day? And, you know, instead of sitting down and saying, we're going to talk, it's kind of like when you're driving in a car. It's easier to talk to someone then. But no one else in my family likes to play with us because we have our own rules. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever read The Accidental Tourist. They have a card game they play, and they make up their own rules. Well, our rules are that you can use the premium square more than once. So if I make a word on a triple word a tile, then I get the triple. And if my husband puts an S on the word, he gets the triple as well.
Oh, okay.
And, we also, if the one player gets at least 100 points more than the other player, the player that's losing gets 2 turns in a row, so you can catch up. Huh. And we also use a dictionary to check on words, because my husband, when we started playing, he was a very poor speller. And so I have a little up on him in that I'm a former English teacher. But it's taught him to be a better speller, and we've actually learned new words, because sometimes he'll spell a word and I'll think, that's not a word, and then we'll look it up, and sure enough, it is.
So, wow.
That's my word story.
All right, Kathy, I love it. Scrabble over dinner. Thanks for that. WPR's digital marketing director, Judith Heisey, shared a Scrabble story. My husband and I are gamers, she writes. They sure are. Earlier in a marriage, we would play Scrabble. It always left one of us rather unhappy with the other. I play to make the most interesting word I can for the tiles my tray and on the board. Everyone wins when it's a beautiful game of creative word making. My husband plays to win the score, to take or block bonus spaces, wreck the boards so there's nowhere to play, which is super annoying. And then one day they were playing in the park, hunched over the board. There was a huge gust of wind. The board tumbled over and blew off the table. Tiles were everywhere. Judith writes, the universe spoke. The path to our happiness as a married couple did not include Scrabble. Haven't played each other since at least 20 years. Back to your calls now. Ed is with us in Deerfield. Ed, hi.
Hi, this is Ed. And I would just like to make the comment on both Sudoku and the Ken-Ken. Excuse me. I've been doing the Ken-Ken and the Sudoku with the State Journal, and I started out just doing one. Then I got to second level and third level, and so I'm working my way up. But one of the things that I really like about it is it keeps your mind thinking. You go from, well, if this leads to this, then that must lead to another thing. And I really enjoy that, because it just helps your mind to jump around a little bit, to think. You just don't think in a straight line. You have to, you know, move from left to right or right to left, whichever.
I love it, Ed. Good brain exercise. Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Brian joins us next in Eau Claire. Brian, hi.
Yeah, hi there. So we just got a game at Christmas called Kids Against Maturity. It's a card game, and there's two stacks of cards. One of them has a sentence with a blank in it, and then the other stack of cards has one word in it. So you get like 10 of these one-word cards. Somebody reads the card with the blank in it, and you fill in the blank with the cards you have in your hand. And then the person who read the card picks the funniest one, you know, and it's hilarious.
And is it like laugh-out-loud funny when you're playing, Brian?
Absolutely. Yeah, we did it with our kids at home, had a blast, did it with my sister over Christmas, and there must have been 10 of us around the table, and we had a really good time. A lot of fun, a lot of laugh-out-loud stuff.
That sounds like kind of like Mad Libs in game form, sort of.
Exactly.
I love it. Brian, thank you so much for sharing that with us today. Thanks to everyone who called in and our colleagues who shared their stories as well. Still time for you to share your favorite brain teaser, word game, puzzle, you name it. Keep it going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Leave a comment about which games and puzzles you like to play, tips you've picked up along the way, what you get out of playing. You just want to brag about how awesome you are at Wordle or some other game, knock yourself out again. Share that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Love to hear more about your favorite games and puzzles. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a presidential historian about the latest reporting on the aftermath of the 2020 election and the former President Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the election. A lot of new documents coming out, statements for people at the center of the story as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a psychologist tells us why many of our minds have gone into pandemic survival mode and how we can help shake it off. Now, in a statement about the 2020 election last weekend, former President Donald Trump falsely claimed that his vice president could have overturned the election. It's after he suggested he might pardon January 6th rioters should he become president again. Here he is at a rally in Texas on Saturday.
If I run and if I win, we will treat those people from January 6th fairly. We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons because they are being treated so unfairly.
This comes as reporting is shedding new light on strategies that Trump and his advisors considered and attempted in order to keep Trump in office despite his election loss. We're taking a closer look at these stories, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the state of elected government in America? Do stories about the 2020 election and its aftermath make you worry more? Do you think we need to make changes to strengthen democratic institutions like voting and elections? What do you think as you hear more details trickling in about the days between the November 2020 election and January 6th of the next year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jeffrey Engel is a history professor and founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's good to talk to you.
Before we dig into some of the individual particular stories here, you've been quoted in the news saying that you're worried that the American people may be getting numb to this steady disclosure of facts, maybe not seeing the big picture and how serious it is.
I think that's true. I think that we are suffering from a couple of problems here as a nation. The first, of course, and I'm hardly the first person to say this, is our diffuse and divided media ecosystems. So if you are watching, you know, one television program, let's say MSNBC, you probably have heard a lot about the January 6th event. I like to call it insurrection. If you're watching Fox News or another right-wing media outlet, you probably are not concerned with it. You're probably more concerned with something else that they are focusing on. So we have half the population essentially hearing about a problem and half not. And then the second aspect of what makes Americans, I think, numb to this is that we've been through 5 years of a great deal of presidential news. Let's put it that way. The president was a much more active figure under the Trump administration in your personal daily lives and in your conversations, frankly, I would argue, than almost any other time in American history. So after 5 years with competing ecosystems and competing elements of news coming out constantly, there's only so many times that the American public can be shocked into action, shocked into even answering the beep on their phone that tells them there's something new. So the fact that we have something very important going on in trying to understand what happened at the end of the election, after the election, and January 6th, the fact that that's very, very important doesn't mean that Americans essentially still have the energy to keep up with the pace of events.
President Trump talked in that Texas rally about the idea of he'd wished that Vice President Pence had overturned the election. Some of the language in the past had been, at least in public, taking more time to investigate allegations of fraud. Is it significant that the O word, overturn word, came out?
You know, I actually don't think so, except in the sense that it's going to cause us to hopefully have these conversations. So I appreciate that aspect of it. But President Trump is not one to, former President Trump is not one to particularly choose his words wisely often. As we know, one of the major downfalls of his White House was his own proclivity to say things that were inappropriate or would grab headlines of the kind that he didn't want. So I don't think it's necessarily important that Trump has used the word overturn. What is significant is the amount of information that's coming out that shows that that's exactly what he designed to do. That's exactly what he wanted to do after after November of the election, when it became clear that he did not win. The number of times and different ways and different manifestations of policies designed to do just that, overthrow a duly accredited election, are astounding. There really is no precedent for it in American history. And I want to be careful when I say that, because, you know, as a historian, we always tell our students not to use the word unprecedented, because usually it just means you're not trying hard enough. If you look further, you can find something. I can't find any parallel to a president so actively rejecting the voice of the people in their national vote.
One of the particulars that's come out over the last couple of weeks has been a talk of seizing voting machines and then President Trump inquiring about that, encouraging the idea first from the Justice Department, the Defense Department, Homeland Security, trying to find an avenue to seize voting machines in especially battleground states. What are you seeing there? What do you make of those disclosures?
Again, I don't mean to be hyperbolic about it, but this is actually terrifying. This is what governments that are uninterested in being democratic or listening to the voice of the people do. They seize the ballot boxes. I'll give you a great example from American history, in a sense, which is that one of the reasons that the United States went into Panama in 1989 to depose Manuel Noriega was because he had done just that. His troops had taken all the ballot boxes. And once they're in somebody else's possession, you know, it's hard to know who's stuffing what. So, you know, once you have, in essence, the government being able to determine not just who won in a freer and fair way, but essentially using force to impose its own decision-making on the ballot boxes, that's a very, very dangerous thing. That's very typical of the way that fascist organizations operate and retain power. You know, I hate to be exaggerated hyperbolic words, but this is actually a rejection of democracy, and especially since we know that there were no federal statutes that would have given the president authority to do this, whether in the Justice Department or the Department of Homeland Security or the Pentagon. And if you think back on the moments in the weeks that passed after the election, one of the most significant events to my mind was the resignation of the Attorney General, William Barr. William Barr, who had done as much, if not more than anyone, to keep Trump in office during the difficult time for him of the impeachment and the Mueller investigation. And so William Barr resigned because he would not go forward with the president's desire to do just this, to push the big lie and to seize ballot boxes. So if you have perhaps the most virulent of President Trump supporters saying, "Mr. President, I'm sorry, that goes too far," that should give pause to anyone, I think, who continues to support the former president's activities.
Talking to historian Jeffrey Engel, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, about the latest on efforts to overturn the 2020 election by President Trump and his closest colleagues. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions to the latest news, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. It's a great topic. I'm a little concerned that we keep talking about this is what they wanted to do. This is what he wanted to try and do, and unsuccessfully, which there was in reality almost no way for it to happen. I mean, we have such divided government. This isn't a Noriega situation where the guy actually ran the military by himself. So he can't command the military to do anything. He can't command any of these other departments to do anything. He can command individuals, and most of them resigned or rebelled against him. But I think that our narrative here on this whole thing seems to be more that they're trying to prevent him from running again, which is fine with most of us who are more in the center on this country. And yet it's not doing anything legislatively to move this country forward, because there's no threat that an individual president of the United States could ever have in this country. It's almost basic civics.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Jeff, this is, a common argument. Yes, President Trump and his colleagues tried to do these things, but the Secretary of State of Georgia pushed back. The Attorney General pushed back. There were safeguards there. It didn't happen, so the system worked.
You know, I'm really glad that your caller asked this really important question. As he put it, it is basic civics, but there's a hidden step within basic civics that we don't often tell people when we teach them that in school or when we talk about these things openly, and that is that laws only work if people follow them. Chains of command only work if people follow them. As to your caller's point, there were many people who resigned rather than fulfill President Trump's desires in this instance and throughout American history. People who resigned because a president had said something that they thought was illegal or unconstitutional. And the way this typically plays out is that the president keeps on firing people until he finds the guy who will do it. Most famously, actually, you know, Richard Nixon's decision to fire the special investigator of him for Watergate. He fired the first attorney general, then the second, and then finally found somebody who was willing to do that deed, which happened to be Robert Bork, hurt him for his own future in the Supreme Court. So we have to remember that we are, yes, a nation of laws, but we're also a nation of people. And if people choose to not follow the law, or to give them, to be fair, if people choose to follow the person who is in their authority chain of command, who is doing something illegal or wrong, then we have a problem. And as you mentioned, the Secretary of State of Georgia is, I think, a wonderful example of this, that, you know, we have on tape. And I don't know why this, frankly, was not enough to bring more fury down on his head, shall we say, if not legal consequences. We have the President of the United States telling the Secretary of State of Georgia that I need you to find me votes. Imagine if the Secretary of State had said yes. And it's not far-fetched to think of a Secretary of State saying yes, because there are many people running currently to be Secretary of States of their own state around the country who have basically made it their campaign promise that they would have said yes in that moment. So laws only work when good people follow them.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jeffrey Engel, presidential historian, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, with us today to talk about some of the new information coming to light about former President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election outcome. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the former president's interest in having voting machines seized in various states? How about the effort to put forth electors who weren't electors, including here in Wisconsin? Do you have questions about these stories? What do you think they mean for the health of our democracy. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election and new reporting about former President Trump's efforts to stay in power. Jeffrey Engel with Southern Methodist University stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Jeff, before we go back to our callers, I want to bring up a part of the story with a Wisconsin connection. Republicans in seven states that Biden ultimately won had their electors get together and cast ballots. Two of those states, they made them conditional. Like, yeah, we're not the electors unless court rulings determine that Donald Trump won. Five states, including Wisconsin, didn't have that condition. They just said, we're the electors. There are talks of investigation over signing a fraudulent document here. How important is this part of the story?
I think it's an important part of the story, not necessarily from the legal aspect, and I'm not expert enough to speak to the actual legality of what may or may not have been crossing a law line. But the fact that we have people throughout multiple states who are operating in the same way, following the same pattern, doing the same actions to try to use the same deception, that certainly meets the common sense theory of common sense definition of conspiracy. And to go back to an earlier point that I think one of your callers made, it is absolutely true, thankfully, that President Trump and his efforts to subvert the national will in this election did not work. And one might ask, well, if it didn't work, what's the harm? No harm, no foul, right? So I think we should remind ourselves that, look at this in a different context. If you are planning to rob a bank and begin to try to rob a bank and you get foiled in robbing the bank, you don't walk away scot-free. That's still an illegal act.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Hadi is with us in Madison. Hadi, hi.
Yeah, hi. I like the example your guest just gave. You don't get out of jail because you didn't succeed. That's crazy talk. What I wanted to ask the guest is, can you explain to me how in this world we are not all in the street after what we are seeing? It's impossible that everybody is sitting on his hands. Oh, okay, yeah, let's see what happens. This is crazy. In the United States, you have a president trying to steal and make a coup. Let's call it what it is. It's a coup, attempted coup.
Thanks for the call, Hadi. Jeff, Hadi sees this as a coup. Surprised that the United States, Americans are taking it so calmly.
Let me give a counterfactual word of opportunity for people to relax in one sense. As I've said, this is a terrible situation that's going on, but I do think it's important to recognize it could be worse. So right now we have somewhere, depending on your poll, between 50 and 70% of people who declare themselves to be Republicans stating that they believe that the last election was inappropriate, that the last election had some malfeasance, that the last election was in some way not true. We have a smaller percentage who don't believe that Joe Biden is the lawful president, but still almost a majority of Republicans who say that. I would suggest that if Republicans really did think that the wrong person was in jail, they would be in the streets. That if Republican legislators through up and down the party, going all the way up through the Senate and the House, really did think that the wrong person was in the White House, that they would be saying much more and doing much more and arguing much more to not thwart the Democratic agenda in Congress, but rather to thwart the fact that there is a undemocratically elected president. So I think this is a moment where, yes, there are true believers out there. There's no doubt about it. And I think President Trump certainly surrounds himself with them. And we've seen that only a few thousand people, as we saw on January 6th, of true believers can cause tremendous mayhem and damage. But I think that the polls that are telling us how many Republicans genuinely believe this stuff are actually not telling us quite the truth. Republicans are saying one thing, but not acting with their feet to demonstrate the other.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Bob in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
Hi. Hello.
Yes, you're on the air, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. Given the last two calls, I'll change up a little bit, but I'll just say this.
what concerns me right now is that I think obviously there's at least a small group of people who are indeed out in the streets, and they're out in the streets based on lies that are told to them. And they ironically, they think that they're doing the right thing. They couch it in words like we're patriots trying to protect our country, but they're not patriots. They're brown shirts. And we are in 1939 Germany right now. I mean, we just don't know it. And the Germans by and large didn't know it when they were in the 30s either. It's what's coming is real bad. If we don't uphold the law, we might as well not have a law. You know, I mean, if you just decide that, hey, the Packers scored 7 and the Vikings scored 23, but we don't like the Vikings, so we're going to say, hey, the Packers won anyway. That's not a game anymore.
Bob, thanks for the call. Jeff, this is a concern I hear often, that what we saw in the run-up to January 6th on January 6th didn't work then, but it was a dress rehearsal for something worse that might come in the future.
That is actually my concern. And to your caller's point, I have great sympathy for the people in the streets who are protesting, that small number, who do believe that they are saving democracy. If I thought that democracy was being threatened by a president who was not supposed to be in office, or if President Trump had been successful, in my opinion, in keeping the office when he shouldn't have, I like to think I would be in the streets too. So I'm sympathetic and I appreciate the patriotism they are trying to demonstrate. But I do think that we need to pay very careful attention to the reports that are coming out, the draft documents. Yes, they're draft documents, but they tell us what people around President Trump were thinking and planning and discussing about what to do, seizing the ballot boxes, declaring emergencies, declaring that the president has the power to essentially keep civil order, and the president could actually impose martial law, according to the man who was going to be his national security advisor, actually was his first national security advisor for a few weeks, General Michael Flynn, suggested that President Trump should impose martial law to get his processes done. And frankly, these were last minute haphazard ideas because that most of them were formulated after President Trump had lost the election. I frankly think that if the president had been willing to believe that he was going to lose ahead of time, and the people around him as well, if they had put a lot more thought and a lot more planning into how they were going to do this with months in advance to prep, then we'd have a different story. So we now have years for people to prep for the next opportunity. And as to go back to the earlier caller's point, it's a trite thing to say, but it could not be more true. The fundamental element of American civic life is that it requires good people following the law, period. Without that, we have different problems.
Bob, thanks for the call. And just our last minute and a half or so, Jeff, are there guardrails that you think we could put into place that would help prevent these things?
I think transparency is good. The more that we have open, transparent elections, not elections necessarily that where people find it more difficult to vote, but we can have a better sense of what votes actually look like, would be helpful. But I actually have to say that one surprising change in my mind, surprising to me, of what's happened after the election has been my desire to approve suddenly of the Electoral College and of the diffuse nature of the way that we elect presidents. I had previously argued that the Electoral College was undemocratic, and I think it is. I think it disenfranchises voters who come from particular states and helps voters who come from smaller states in particular to have greater power. But that's a necessary flaw, I think, for what the Electoral College and our diffuse system actually gave us after January 6th, which was an opportunity for individuals to make that right call. The Secretary of State of Georgia and of other states to be able to actually follow the law, not just what their party superiors were telling them. I think we'd have a different scenario if you take the hypothetical that we have a national election, one campaign, one election, one ballot box, if you will, and the person who is in charge of counting the votes actually reports to the President of the United States. I think we would have had a different scenario. So the fact that the Secretary of State of Georgia could rightly say to the President of the United States, sir, I don't work for you, is a really important safeguard in itself. So as Congress considers future changes, I do hope that they will keep the diffuse nature of the 50 different elections, even though, as I said, that's not something I would have anticipated myself saying 6 months ago.
Jeff, thanks again for joining us today.
It's Good to talk to you. I'll talk to you in happier circumstances next time.
That's Jeffrey Engel, history professor, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, with the latest on the 2020 elections. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent continues the series of interviews with Wisconsin mayors. This time it's a visit to La Crosse. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Our neighbors in Minnesota are in the news for giving official fun names to their fleet of snowplows. It's a growing trend. While I was looking up that story, I saw something I missed. Appleton announced their snowplow names a couple weeks ago, and they've got a cool service map, so you can see which plow serves which part of the city. Now, a couple of them are named with famous Appletonians in mind. Willem DeSnow, actor Willem Dafoe, is from Appleton, as he mentioned on Saturday Night Live just last weekend. And there's Magnificent Snowdini, a tribute to Harry Houdini's Appleton roots. One plow is named Clark Gable. I can't find a connection to Appleton there. Fill me in if you know there is one or if I'm missing a pun. There's some science fiction and fantasy in the mix. The Blizzard of Oz, Darth Blader, Truck Rogers, and Snowpiercer. There's some dairy theme, cheese sled, and utterly movable. And don't forget Snowy McSnowface. If your community is named It's Snowplows, I want to snow about it. No, but really, email ideas@wpr.org. Keep on trucking. This is Central Time.